Okay, so this is continuing our We're Separate Because series, and this afternoon, exactly this afternoon, I want to speak about diet and health. Now, I should start off by saying, is there anyone here who is in perfect health and has absolutely no issues with anything at all? Oh, that's a relief. That's good then. That's good. Because, okay, we look forward to a time when we might live in perfect health in heaven. But I think what we're looking at in this life is making the best of it we can. So if we can do something a little bit better, that's worth going for, isn't it? And so that's the start point I want to look at this morning. But before we even get on to talking about diet and health, there are a couple of foundation stones I want to establish. And in a way, these are almost more important than talking about diet. So here's the first one. Forget what's on the stone. That's irrelevant. That's just a picture from Google. But here's a statement I want to explore a little bit. In most cases, what the Bible calls blessing is simply the consequence of obedience. Okay? So in most cases, when the Bible describes blessings or curses, what it's simply describing is the difference between the consequence of obedience or disobedience. I want to give you two examples. But first of all, have a bit of a think about the way we've come to consider this. Imagine a small child. Now, the small child, as they reach that plug socket with their little narrow fingers to put their finger in it, has no real awareness of the consequences. So what they require is an external agency to say, don't do that. If you do, I'll slap your wrist. Okay? I'll give you another example of this. Imagine you have a small child, and you're going off to visit Auntie Jane, and you need your child to behave. So you say to the little child, you need to do this and not do this. And if you do it, so we're talking as an external agency, we will buy you ice cream on the way home. And if you don't, well, you know, imagine the consequence of your choice, okay? Now, what we're hoping is that as time progresses, the external agency becomes less and less important. And over time, we might find that the child begins to realise for themselves that when they go to see Auntie Jane and they behave well, it turns out Auntie Jane's got a great sense of humour and she tells fantastic stories, and maybe if you're really polite, she even sometimes brings out cake. Alright? And so we begin to see intrinsic consequences and benefits to our behaviour, and this is what we think of as maturity. Now the trouble is that most of us, having grown up in families where our parents acted as that external agency to discipline us, we think the same way about God. God is an external agency constantly telling us how to behave when we visit Auntie Jane and just waiting to give us a slap around the ear all if we don't. But I wonder if that's really true. So, two examples to consider for you. Most of us have or do drive cars. Most of us are aware of the fact that from time to time you need to top up the oil, particularly, ironically, if you drive a very new car. Apparently they burn more oil now than they used to 10 years ago, right? And I think we also may be well aware of the fact, well, particularly if you're daft enough to buy a German one, but there you go. You may well be aware that there are many, many different varieties of oil, and you may well be aware that you need to get the right one. How do we know which is the right one? Do we listen to our next-door neighbour? Do we listen to the dodgy backstreet mechanic? No, we go to the manufacturer's handbook, don't we? Okay. And we all know, don't we, that if we put the right oil in, we're going to get better performance, better fuel economy, and a longer-lasting engine. And if we put the wrong oil in, we'll get none of those things. All right, why is that? Well, I want to offer you two scenarios. Scenario number one, let's imagine we drive, I don't know, a Honda, okay? So scenario number one is that in some glass-fronted skyscraper somewhere, probably in Tokyo, sits an executive in an office with a big crystal ball. And every instance of a Honda that is still running shows up as a little dot on that crystal ball. And when someone puts the right oil in their engine, that dot briefly flashes up green. And immediately the executive pushes a button, summons in one of their operatives and says, quick, go to that address there and tinker with their car to make sure that it performs better, is better on fuel and lasts longer. And of course, when you put the wrong oil in your engine, that little dot flashes up red. And immediately the executive sees it, pushes the button, summons in an operative and says, quick, go to that address over there, messing with their car so that it performs worse, uses more fuel and breaks down more easily. That's scenario number one. Scenario number two is just a natural consequence of putting the right oil in the engine means it will run longer, perform better, and give you better fuel economy. Which scenario seems more probable?
Second.
Okay. Now I'm going to give you a biblical example. Now excuse us getting into a little bit of human biology here, but it's important that we do. This was a promise God made to Israel. He said, "He will love you and bless you and increase your numbers," speaking about himself. "He will bless the fruit of your womb, the crops of your land, your grain, your wine and olive oil, etc., etc. You will be blessed more than any other people. None of your men or women will be childless." Let's consider for a moment two scenarios. Scenario number one is that God sits up there in heaven and he looks down on the human race, on anyone who's trying to have a baby, and he says, "Aha, are they keeping all the rules? Good, quick." And he dispatches an angel to help them procreate, which is a slightly disturbing thought, isn't it? But anyway, there are instances in the Bible where that happened. But the very fact that there are so few of them tells us that was not the normal state of affairs. Okay? And so I've picked out three here. Interestingly enough, a bit of research in the Jewish commentaries. Did you know that was the name of the mother of Samson? No, nor did I until now, so there we are, interesting. There were women who struggled to conceive. They were obviously godly women, because otherwise God would not have entrusted them with the children he did. Yeah, there are others as well, but yeah, okay. Interesting, now we'll come back to this thought a little bit later on. Now let's get into a little bit of human biology. Because one of the things that happens is that when a young couple are trying for a baby and perhaps not being successful, before we ever get to medical intervention, there are natural methods, are there not? Okay. In some cases, a woman is only considered fertile. I say in some cases because we have two children that prove this isn't true. But in some cases, a woman is only fertile for certain days of every month. Okay. So, you don't go out to play football or go for a movie on those days, right, if you're trying for a child. Now, here's something quite interesting. In Leviticus 15, God said this: "When a woman has her regular flow of blood, the impurity of her monthly period will last 7 days, and anyone who touches her will be unclean until evening." Now, I should explain that the verse is slightly ambiguous, but Jewish tradition is that the 7 days were always counted from the end of the woman's period. Okay. I suppose the reason would be that if you counted from the beginning, and some women have a particularly long cycle, 8 days, 9 days in some cases, you'd be counting them as clean again before they were. Okay. Now, most commentators simply say, "Oh, look, you know, this was to do with hygiene," and that's a very, very good point. Any issue of bodily fluids, male or female, don't go any further with that thought, left the person unclean, and there were particular things they had to do with them. But here's something very interesting for you to think about. Let's assume that most women's cycle is between 4 and 7 days. Okay? Now, during that time, and during the 7 days which followed, it wasn't just that you couldn't be intimate with your wife. You couldn't touch her, couldn't hold hands, couldn't sit on the same settee, certainly couldn't sleep in the same bed. So for nearly half of every month, it was literally no touchy at all. And then you get to the end of those 7 days of impurity. Now, I think we can probably guess what Mr. and Mr. Israelite, Mrs. and Mr. Israelite are up to. Yeah?
Lots of touchy.
Lots of touchy. Okay, they're probably not going to go out socialising on one of those days. And what do you notice about our calendar? That the return to intimacy, according to the Bible, which is my green arrows, aligns precisely with what is known as the standard days method, and is precisely on the woman's most fertile time of the month. In other words, if you keep God's law, you can rock solid guarantee that this couple are intimate right at the time when it's most likely to lead to conception. And there's something more about this, which occurred to me as I was studying this. You see, when you read about these natural methods in medical journals and so on, the one thing they will never say is, "and don't have anything to do with each other for 2 weeks prior." They'll never say that. And I wonder if that's key to the success of this. And on the same thought, furthermore, you will notice among the women in the Bible who are mentioned as struggling to conceive, that in more than half the cases the husband had another wife. In other words, while the wife was counted as unclean and unable to enjoy any intimacy, the husband simply switched tents and carried right on, and guess what? They couldn't have a child. Interesting, isn't it? So again, we find ourselves asking, does God need to send an angel from heaven to intervene to make sure that the Israelites are fertile, or has he set in place certain rules which, if we follow them, lead to natural consequences? Mm-hmm. Okay. So our conclusion to this is, I met my thing at work, is that good consequences arise from wise behaviour. That God teaches us that wise behaviour, and therefore obedience to God's word produces good consequences. Now, I mentioned those three or four or five different women who couldn't conceive. You would think, in a way, that they're exceptions, but in a way, the exceptions actually prove the rule. So you think about it this way. If that was a promise which God fulfilled by dispatching angels to work, then if you could find a single example of a couple who kept the rules but couldn't have a baby, then God's promises would be worthless. But if instead we're talking about natural consequences, we're all familiar with the idea that any natural consequences can vary. You know, you can have someone who rigorously maintains their car, but it breaks down all the time. You can have someone else who never maintains their car, and the wretched thing goes on year after year after year without ever giving them any trouble. There are exceptions, we understand that. So in a way, the exceptions actually prove the rule. There is, however, this point, which is that we don't always understand why God ordered something. So I'll give you one example of that. Anyone who's interested in their gardening knows that the real big trend in the last few years is to say, let's sow lots of different crops together, because if we do it wisely, we can have crops that take something out of the soil planted amongst crops that put that thing back into the soil, and therefore we get better yields. Polyculture, it's called. And it's all the rage, because if we do this, we can cut down on pests, we can eliminate the need for artificial fertilisers and so on. But God said, do not sow two different kinds of seed in the same field. I have no idea why. What are the chances that God knows what he's talking about? Right? Okay. So, let's move on to a second foundation stone, which is this. That though God is unchanging, his commands towards us do change. Now, that might be an interesting thing for us to consider. It might even be a little bit revolutionary to think about. But let me give you an example. Sacrifice. God does not change with regard to the fact that he cannot tolerate sin. Furthermore, God does not change in respect of the fact that he gives us a mechanism for dealing with sin and guilt. But, have a think about the timeline of history. From the fall, down to Sinai, then down to Calvary. If you read the various instances where it talks about animal sacrifice, you will notice that animal sacrifice is instituted immediately after the fall. But the animal to be sacrificed is a sheep. And it can be sacrificed by anyone, anywhere. Right? So Cain and Abel, they're not the patriarchs in their family, but they get into that bit of dispute over what kind of sacrifice is acceptable to God. Abraham builds altars anywhere he goes. Now then you come to Sinai, and things change a little bit. First of all, there are many, many more sacrifices stipulated. Many different kinds of sacrifices stipulated. With a wide variety of different animals, depending on who you are and what your status in the community is. But the sacrifices can only be carried out by a priest and only at the temple. And you'll remember from the reading of Israel's history that there were times when a king said, oh, look, it's too far for you to travel down there and try to set up a centre of sacrifice somewhere else. And God wasn't very pleased with that at all. And then we come down to the present age, where we read in Hebrews that Christ, after his death, ascended into heaven, went through the veil into the most holy place and offered his own blood. And now there are no more animal sacrifices. We may ourselves come boldly before the throne of God to ask for forgiveness. So although God is unchanging, the methods he uses or the things he instructs us to do change. Right? And what's really interesting about this kind of timeline is that you cannot live in this phase and say, oh yes, but look, I found this thing in the Bible here that says, therefore I'm going to set up an altar in my back garden and start killing animals on it. Likewise, if you live during this time period here, you could not say, oh look, you know, I've got this amazing revelation. I don't think I need to bring those sacrifices to the temple and the priest. I think I'll just pray and ask for forgiveness. They're arbitrary instructions, they're arbitrary commands, but they change down through the time period of history. So, well, okay. I hope you like complicated charts. I'm not suggesting we should all sign up to the theological theory of dispensationalism, but people have noted that in various different ways, there are different time periods and different ways in which God deals with humankind in those different time periods. More of that perhaps another time. So, in conclusion then, to this foundation stone, God is unchanging. Furthermore, his intentions towards us do not alter. But what God tells us to do, or allows us to do, can change. So, to summarise, blessings are mostly the consequences of wise or good behaviour, and though God is unchanging, his commands to us do change. Now, with those two foundation stones in place, we'll now move on and look at the topic we actually started with, which is diet. Alright. In the beginning, in Genesis chapter 1, God had just manufactured the first man and woman, and he told them what was the best thing for them to eat. Genesis 1, God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it, they will be yours for food. No dairy, no meat, minimal preparation, because you don't need to cook those things. You just eat them as they are. And this was the diet, this was the manufacturer's specification. This was the oil the manufacturer specified to run the engine on. Quite simple. Now, the next time we come across anything major said about diet is roughly 2,000 years later, when in Genesis chapter 9 we have the story of the flood. And all of a sudden God gives a new commandment, a new instruction. He says, everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I once gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. Okay? And if you think about it, that's true. That everything which moves about is at the top of the menu in some part of the world. Things we think would be utterly disgusting, the Chinese love to bits, and things they wouldn't touch are the top of the French menu or whatever else. Okay? So somewhere in the world, this is quite literally true. Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Now wait a minute, you say. Hang on. Okay, so let's discuss this. One of the options is, yes, but it doesn't really quite mean what it said. It means everything that lives and moves, which is categorised as clean, will be food for you. Okay. Well, there are some problems with that. The first one is, that would assume that God's people were routine meat eaters prior to the flood. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. I'd like to think that until the necessity arose, God's people, as being distinct from the sons of man, did not kill and consume God's creation. But that's just my own theory. I have something else that's more important. Some of you, if you're local, may recognise that building. Okay. Let me describe to you the factory that sat at the back of that building. Huge, huge factory, stretched all the way from Sainsbury's petrol station to the very back end of the retail park. What's wrong with the description I've just given you? See, that's the beauty of it. It's so succinct and such a commonly used rhetorical device, we don't even notice it. How can I describe a factory as stretching from Sainsbury's petrol station to the back of the retail park, where neither of those places could be built until the factory was gone? Alright? It's a very commonly used rhetorical device in writing, in teaching, in preaching, that we use something with which we can identify now to help our listeners, readers, students understand something that was. So when Moses, who wrote down the law about clean animals and unclean animals, is trying to describe the fact that God sent seven pairs of herbivores, that doesn't quite work, prey animals, yeah, not quite, why don't I just call them clean animals? He's using the same technique. He's projecting back into Israel's history the language which they are now familiar with of clean and unclean. That doesn't necessarily mean that Noah knew what clean and unclean meant, or that prior to the flood he and his family routinely killed and ate God's creation. But after the flood, you know, we used to think of the flood as just being, oh, the water got quite deep. But as we've come to study it a bit more and think it through, we realise that all of the geological destruction, which evolution, with its billions of years, puts down to asteroid strikes and tectonic plate movements and volcanoes, we've got to explain all of that by the flood. So it must have been the most colossal destructive upheaval. Volcanoes, earthquakes, glaciation, all of that happened at the time of the flood. What kind of landscape would Noah have stepped out onto? And we really think he's going to step out and go, well, I won't eat anything except, you know, some vegetables. Good luck starving to death for 9 months, you know. So in that desperate situation, God says, well, if you can catch a shrimp, perhaps you better go for it. All right? Remember what we said. God himself does not change. His principle that he wants the best for us does not change. But the actual instructions he gives at various different times may well change. Alright, so moving on. The next time we come to anything major about diet is, of course, at the Exodus, where God gives these very, very clear stipulations about what is clean and unclean. Now, what's fascinating about this is that this was not revolutionary. It was merely slight evolution because, for example, Herodotus wrote, the Egyptians are the healthiest of all men next to the Libyans. They eat bread, making those which they call whatever, of coarse grain. For wine, they use a drink made from barley, for they have no vines in their country. They eat fish, either raw or sun-dried, or preserved with brine. Quails and ducks and small birds are salted and eaten raw. All other kinds of birds, as well as fish, are even roasted or boiled. Sounds like a pretty good diet, doesn't it? Especially when you realise that there's a tomb inscription. It's a rather long-winded myth and a rather long-winded fable, but the long and the short of it is the Egyptians considered pork unclean, and they wouldn't eat it, they wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't eat sheep either. Do you remember why it was that Joseph and his family were sent off way over there to live down in the Nile Delta in the swamps? Because they considered sheep and shepherds unclean. They'd eat beef. There were cities where cattle ranching was apparently the thing, but they were pretty choosy about what they ate, and they were pretty healthy. So when God came along to Israel and said, well, let's just refine this a bit further, there shouldn't have been any problem at all. They should have really understood the principle, because, you know, even the Egyptians had animals which were considered ceremonially impure. You couldn't eat those things, okay? But this was a change. It was a better diet. And remember that all of those laws taken together, God laid with them the promise that said, if you do these things, you will not suffer the same diseases as the Egyptians. Consequences? All right. Now, for the next 1,500 years or thereabouts, that was the state of play. And then we come down to the New Testament, to Peter's vision. Now, of course, I think we know the story quite well, that Peter is up there thinking about lunch and wondering what the cook's producing. And as he falls asleep, he dreams of this sheep being let down from heaven, and in it are all sorts of animals. And the voice says, arise, kill, and eat. And Peter says, no, I won't do that. I've never touched or eaten anything which is impure. Okay? But God responds and says, do not call anything impure that God has made clean. Okay. Obviously, the primary purpose of this vision was to convince Peter that in a few minutes' time, when some Gentiles knocked on the door and said, can you come and preach at our house? Peter was not to say, oh, I'm not going there, you're unclean. But later on in the chapter, we find that when Peter went down to their house, he stayed with them several days. Did he drink only water during that time? Or would he have eaten with them? Bear in mind, there wasn't a KFC on every corner in those days. Bear in mind also that it would have been the most gross insult for anyone to reject the hospitality of your host and say, well, thanks very much for preparing a lovely meal, but I'm off down the road to get something that's ceremonially clean. So Peter would have eaten Gentile food. And even if Cornelius was incredibly culturally aware and kept bacon off the menu, the food would still have been prepared in a Gentile kitchen by Gentile cooks, who would very likely have included at least some non-kosher ingredients. And to give you a feel for what the problem was, a little bit further over in Galatians, a few years later on down the line, Peter, well, let's read it. Paul says, when Cephas Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself. In other words, even years later, Peter knows that what he's doing in eating with the Gentiles is not acceptable to a strict Jew. So when the strict Jews come down from Jerusalem, Peter suddenly goes all hypocritical and won't eat with the people he ate with yesterday, because he knows that what he's doing in eating with them makes him ceremonially unclean. Okay? Now, just to bring this forward to the present day, and my argument here is a bit like after the flood, there's a necessity. All right. Last month, 5th of September 2018, all the papers carried the story. Of course, some sensationalised it more than others, but here we go. Here was the headline in the Telegraph on 5th of September 2018, undeclared animal DNA found in 1 in 5 meat products tested. Okay. Unidentified animal DNA was found in more than a fifth of samples of meat products tested by the Food Watchdog last year. It has emerged. Meat labelled as lamb was most likely to contain traces of other animals' DNA, followed by beef and goat. Cow DNA was the most commonly found contaminated, followed by pig. If you are a meat eater and you've eaten meat more than 4 times, you've eaten pork. That's the simple reality of it. And it gets worse still, because laboratory tests found traces of pork in Sainsbury's own brand meat-free meatballs and traces of turkey in a vegan macaroni ready meal from Tesco's. It is impossible for us, living among Gentiles, to really meaningfully eat only a clean diet. So in the moment of transition from the Jews being a nation with their own country and their own butchers and their own shops, who are all doing everything according to God's word, and as those people spread out into the rest of the world and go to live among Gentiles, God says, look, it's not the best, but because of the necessity, go ahead. Because what else could he do? You know, we cannot really, this is something that I know we eat, Tesco's meat-free, apparently not so meat-free meatballs, not very often, but from time to time. So what are you going to say? Well, get out of church because you've eaten pork. Right? So we've got a problem, and a bit like the necessity after the flood brought about a necessity of change of diet, so our present age has to bring about a necessity of change of diet. However, let's wrap this up. When we think about our health, there are certain principles in the Bible which just cannot be avoided. First of all, it says this, do not be deceived, God cannot be mocked, a man reaps what he sows. In other words, it isn't a miracle, it isn't an angel coming down from heaven, it's a simple matter of consequence. The nearer we live to the original diet God gave us, the better our health will be in the long run. The further we live from the original diet God gave us, the worse our health will be in the long run. The only trouble with this one is, you can eat whatever you want when you're 20, it doesn't come back to haunt you until you're 50 or 60. Generally speaking. Some people it happens earlier, but generally speaking, you can get away with anything for years. But in the end, God is not mocked. We reap what we eat. I paraphrase because that's not what it said. The second point is this, and Paul raises this in speaking about food, though admittedly in a slightly different context. He says, look, I have the right to do anything, but not everything is beneficial. Okay? So, if you want a legal definition, can you go home and eat pork sausages? Yes. Is it beneficial? No. It's a very simple principle, but one which we seem to miss. We get all tied up in the legalese of the old covenant and say, no, that's an unclean animal. Yeah, so are a lot of other things. So are a lot of the things we think are clean, but we're eating them and it turns out they've got pork in them. Or we think we're eating beef and it turns out we're eating kangaroo. Or, you know, whatever else. Okay? But here's, in a way, the one we really need to think about, which is temperance. Temperance has sort of come around to mean simply not drinking alcohol. But I like C.S. Lewis's definition of mere Christianity, where he says, temperance referred not specifically to drink, but to all pleasures, and it meant not abstaining, but going the right length and no further. And it reminds me of a very interesting story. Pastor Richard Vine, a good number of years ago, had a minor heart attack. Now, he was a man who used to run marathons, so he was fit. And he had a minor heart attack, and he was kind of all right afterwards. He went along and had the ECG and all the tests, and he went to the doctor and said, "Look, I can't understand why this would happen to me. I eat such a healthy diet." And the doctor said, "Well, no, you don't." "Yes, I'm a vegetarian, I'm this." He said, "Yeah, but you're overweight." In other words, despite eating the right stuff, he had failed in the going the right length, but no further. And he had a doctor who was man enough to actually tell him that, and he went on a diet and lost weight and is still living healthily to this day. The interesting thing about temperance also is this, that the enemy continually changes his coat. When many of the formative thinking that's formed our church's thinking on temperance came into being, gin was the big problem in society. What's the biggest killer in society today? Obesity. Refined sugar. Yeah. We need to constantly change what we think of in terms of temperance in order to live by the principle that we reap what we sow, and that although all things are permissible, not everything is beneficial. We need to be aware and alert, and we need to change what we're doing to respond to that. So in wrapping this all up, blessings are for the most part simply consequences. Good consequences come from following wise advice such as that God gives us in the Bible. And the big question is for us. Are we smart enough to actually live by the advice that God gives us? Or do we think that we're somehow different and we'll get away with it? And I'll leave you with that thought, because it's not a matter of salvation, but it is a matter that we will benefit in the long run if we get as close as we possibly can to God's original diet for humankind.